From Islamic Finance News, the world's leading Islamic finance news provider, this is IFN Podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. Bonjour. Good morning, everyone. A very energetic morning today. I just want to say it's a pleasure to be back at the SC. You know, we have an excellent lineup of speakers today, including the first panel. We have Bengwan, Mushtaq, Masliza, and Raja Ami here to really dive deeper into the policy, regulatory, and, you know, growth strategies with regards to Islamic sustainable finance and investment. So hopefully for the next hour, we will discuss on this topic. Of course, as Andrew has mentioned, this is supposed to be an interactive session. We really welcome questions. You find that you do have question cards on the table for you at any time. When you already have a question, just raise it up. One of our colleagues will come and collect the question cards from you. Also, midpoint, I will also stop and open for Q&A to the floor. Yeah. So I would like to start the session by having each of our speakers here today to share your opinion. In your opinion, what is the single most significant or important factor influencing or, you know, impacting the progress of Islamic sustainable finance? Bengwan, perhaps I can start with you.
Sure. Thank you. First, I'd like to thank Red Money and Islamic Finance News for inviting me to be a panelist. And I was looking at the brochures that I appear to be the only corporate in the panel for today's discussion. That's a surprise. Okay, I'm looking from the angle of me as a corporate rather than me as a financier or an advisor. I think the single most important thing, it will be market demand. Yeah, we are very proud that Malaysia is the global leader in Islamic finance. I think it's very well established. I think the next for us to be is the global leader in Islamic sustainable finance. I think I take heed from Dato' Sri's words that Islamic finance and sustainability are not mutually exclusive, they are complementary. We at R. Nicola are proud to issue our first SRS Sukuk 2 years ago, and we have also the first to issue our CBI approved or CBI endorsed Sukuk, the first in the world for CBI, Climate Bond Initiative Sukuk. So, coming back to your question, I think demand is very important, so we need to address that market demand. We see a lot of demand coming from, in our instance, a lot of local domestic institutionals, but I think we need to bring that forward to bring also a lot of international demands to the marketplace. I think if we can pioneer that, we can drive that demand, I think the market will be good. Yeah.
Thank you, and assalamu alaikum. I'm delighted to be here at SC Malaysia. I love this venue and all the great people here. So thank you also to IFN for inviting me to this very honorable panel. So it's a difficult question. There are many factors. But from my perspective at ICMA, in the international capital markets, and primarily in the conventional markets, actually, my answer would be awareness and education. And the reason I say that is that I think it's underappreciated, certainly in the global sustainable finance world, that Islamic products can very easily be sustainable. But not only that, I mean, I think we all know that there is a lot of overlap between Islamic products and sustainable ESG products, but also the global standards which guide the development of sustainable finance products such as the green bond principles, social bond principles, sustainability-linked bond guidance. All of those are extremely and easily applicable to Islamic finance. And the implication of that is that when you look at investors looking for sustainable capital markets products, and the demand far outstrips the supply globally, they can look at Islamic products, Islamic sustainable products, as a very viable investment. And I think that awareness still has some improvement.
Okay. There's so much to say. I think it's difficult to pinpoint one simple factor. But I think if you look at the growth in the market, I would say sustainable Islamic finance, I think what's most important about it is, to me, because I have a 10-year-old son, is climate change awareness. Basically, if you look at Islamic sustainable financing, it's socially and responsible ethical financing. So it ties very much, it's very intertwined. And that's why you see the growth in the local market. I mean, if you look at the sukuk, it's about 80% of issuance overall compared to overall corporate bond issuance. And it's you can see that the growth in ESG or Islamic sustainable financing is also very encouraging, and it's easier for Sharia-based issuance or issuers to adopt ESG financing because there are tangents to it, right? If you look at the growth in the market, yes, you know, we started from a low base. I think pre-COVID, if you look at 2017 to 2019, the percentage, the market share, it's high 1s to low 2%. And now we're looking at, I feel it's very encouraging, about 12 over percent last year and close to about 14% year to date this year. So that's the growth that we see in the market in terms of ringgit ESG sukuk percentage. So to my mind, it's about creating continuous engagement and awareness and increasing the amount of interest in the market.
Rajami?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and assalamu alaikum to everybody in the hall today. If we talk about, the single most contributive factor, as Lisa said, is a bit difficult to highlight specifically one. But I would say the facilitative regulatory framework that we see in the market, as well as the shareholders, and stakeholders' expectations of players in the market, which is really pushing us to that next level. So if you recall, Vanita, last year I had stood on this very stage, so it's quite sentimental. We had announced our triple bottom line framework, you know, exactly 12 months ago. And we're proud to say that today we have actually reported on that framework, where we have achieved 49% of our total financing in alignment with that framework, which was slightly below our target of 51%, but nevertheless, it's something of us to be proud of. So shareholders' expectations, stakeholder expectations, a very facilitative and encouraging regulatory framework really is spurring the market to the next level.
And on that note, Rajami, so as a region, you know, Southeast Asia, what are the challenges that we continue to face in developing the sustainable capital market?
Yeah, so, you know, I looked at this question yesterday when preparing for this this forum, and I'm sure Lisa and the panel will complement as well. But I think first and foremost, the statistics really speak about a very strong existing sustainable market. So we've seen, I mean, just to plug some numbers, as APEC as a whole, in 2023, total share of issuances were about 22% of the market was in sustainable format. And if we look at 2015 to 2022, that grew at a CAGR of 75%. So if we talk about ASEAN countries, last year Malaysia was 27% of the market was sustainable, up from 13% year on year. Singapore was 24%, up from 22%. Indonesia was 13%, up from 11%. And Philippines was 12%. Up from 8. So I think the first and foremost is that there is a sustainable existing market within Southeast Asia. But if you want to know what are the challenges, or if we delve further into the challenges of scaling that market up, you know, there are a few points. Number one would be the labeling of products. So what is deemed as sustainable in one market could be seen in other markets as not sustainable. So, you know, example would be, you know, hydropower, for example, or certain use of proceeds which qualifies in one market. If you take that to the international market, there are some restrictions in terms of that. So I think the standardization of what qualifies should be broad-based. So if you issue a sukuk in Malaysia, an investor in Thailand would see that as of the same standard. Another is the number of investors. So globally, we have a lot of more dedicated green funds. In Malaysia, there's probably about 4 to 5 investors who have signed up to the UNPRI. Although there's many growing sustainable and green investment funds, it's not as deep as what we see globally, who are able to really, you know, take on the risk. The last 2 points would be the currency of offering. Local currency is always an issue when we want to bring international investors into the play. And there was an interesting Fitch article which was published last month, which mentioned that Malaysia's not quite there yet. I mean, mainly because Malaysia's focused on domestic currency, which is not wrong. I mean, don't get me wrong, that's the currency that our businesses need. But if we want to be a global market, there needs to be a certain amount of US dollar financing made available. And then the final point is the evolving of standards, which is really alludes to my first point. And then last is the available of verification providers as well as SPO providers. I mean, again, it's not as deep as what we see internationally, and what we would like to see is a bit more, you know, a common ground between the two.
I think, Beng Guan, you probably, you know, have a few points about this, but I think to issuers, the main point of coming to tap the market is it has to make economic sense. So mostly the challenge is for all the additional groundwork that needs to be done, how do you rationalize the... I'm choosing my words very carefully. How do you rationalize the additional work, the additional monitoring, the additional costs? And I applaud SC's a very proactive stance in terms of the SRI grant and the SRI-linked grant. So that definitely helps the issuer market in terms of managing the certification costs. And I also applaud the government's effort in terms of tax incentives, the tax deduction on SRI's related SUKO expenses. And within the fund management as well, there is some tax incentives for SRI investments. But I think the tax deduction and also the fund management tax exemption ends in 2023. So I hope that this is extended because we do still need that assistance. Even with that, if you look at the marginal cost of savings of issuers that tap the market, it's not as glaring. So it's marginal, but I always encourage issuer clients to look at this option, because at the end of the day, it's about widening your investor base. And of course, you know, if you do a sukuk, you know that conventional investors are agnostic on sukuk products. And over and above, you are able to appeal on natural sukuk investors. And over and above that, overlaying an ESG thematic issuance, you are also targeting the ESG-centric investors. And Ami mentioned that it's a growing market, but there's still a lot of growth to come. But I am encouraged. I think I looked at the latest stats in terms of the growth of SRI funds and the number of funds in Malaysia. That's extremely encouraging. The number of insurance companies, even corporates, and the GLICs adopting this path in maximizing ESG investments, that's also encouraging. And I hope more concerted effort will be put in place, and perhaps a renewed tax deduction and exemption.
Sure, thank you. I'm not sure how much I can add here. I think some wonderful points made by Amir and Maslisa, and you're really in the trenches. I'm a bit on the outside. But let me attempt to tackle this complex question. The way I look at it is maybe on three levels, looking at the overall sustainable finance world. So first of all, at the bottom level is more the technical aspects of sustainable finance. And this is where It's the job of the CFO to put together a sustainable framework. It's ICMA's work to put together guidelines and voluntary standards for green bond issuance, for sustainable finance issuance, for green sukuk issuance, and so on and so forth. These are the technical standards, the KPIs, the metrics, mappings to SDGs, these sorts of things, the technical work that's necessary to actually enable sustainable finance. And I think for the most part, this is going very well. There's been an enormous amount of work done. The two challenges where I think there still need to be tackled is one, of course, the standardization. I think we've gone a long way towards standardization. I think ISSB in particular will be crucial to that, extremely helpful. But there are still some differences of opinion in the markets about what exactly is green, what is not green. And I think one, not to jump ahead a little bit, but one remedy to that is the idea of transition. And to be encouraging a transition for those issuers who may not be green yet. But that's maybe another conversation. The other challenge in terms of the technical standards and the technical work is in terms of data. And really we're seeing with the new reporting requirements coming in globally, I expect there are going to be regulations all across Asia. But at the very least, with the sustainability reporting standards, and also TCFD, TNFD, and other related ones, you're going to need consistent data that's not only available, but that's also translatable, and that's able to be aggregated across companies and across portfolios on a global basis. And that is very hard. It's not insurmountable, but there's a lot of technical work that needs to be done. Now, that's the first level. The second level I would consider, again, very important, is the overall capital markets. And it's not really remarked upon too much, but if you want to look at the issuance volumes of sustainable bonds, green bonds, social bonds, the single biggest factor affecting issuance volumes is global issuance volumes, right? Basically, sustainable bond issuance is highly correlated with vanilla bond issuance. So when the macroeconomic situation is bad and not encouraging international issuance, for example, international green bond issuance will go down. When companies are hurting, when credit is a bit softer, then green bond issuance will go down, just like vanilla issuance goes down. So any kind of effects on the global market are going to affect the green bond market as well. Having said that, there are things that can be done by regulators and by the official sector to encourage the green bond and sustainable finance and sustainable Islamic finance markets, as Ms. Lisa has mentioned a couple of those already. I personally want to give a bit of a positive message where I think the Malaysian official sector, Malaysian SC, Bank Negara, as well as the ASEAN regulators, compared to global official sector, have been one of the most progressive and thoughtful, I think, regulators in terms of encouraging the development of sustainable finance. But, you know, there is still work to be done, obviously, and there are lots of tools that can be made available to do that. Now, sorry, one more, the highest level, which I think may be actually the most important, because the capital markets and bankers like us and, you know, consultants and trade associations can only do so much. Ultimately, your point is exactly right, that a company is only going to issue a sustainable instrument if it makes economic sense for them. And nowadays, if you want to be a green bond issuer, if you want to be a green sukuk issuer, you have to either be green yourself as an issuer, or you have to be on a valid, ambitious transition pathway. If you're not green already, you have to show that you are going to be green very quickly and in a very ambitious way, in alignment with the Paris Agreement, preferably the 1.5 degree scenario. And how are you going to do that? Well, you're going to have to transform your business. And how are you going to transform your business? Well, if your national energy policy, if the regulations governing your own business do not make it economically viable for you to have an ambitious transition pathway, it's going to be very difficult for you to do that. On the flip side, on the more optimistic side, if the national policy, if the national energy policy, the national sustainability policy is very much encouraging transition at the sectoral level, at the corporate level, then that is going to encourage companies to have more ambitious sustainability policies, and that is going to make it more easy for them to become credible in the sustainable finance market.
Great. I think this is a good time to have Bengwan chime in, you know, as an issue. By the way, congratulations on the first world's first climate sukuk. Can you just walk us through a bit the process of like deciding to actually, you know, issue the sukuk? And also, I know your colleagues have already shared the challenges that you actually face in bringing, you know, Islamic ESG products to the market.
I have to say that I think the panelists have spoken a lot in terms of the challenges or the desire of an issuer or the need of an issuer to issue a sustainable finance or sustainable Islamic finance product. But from our point of view, from our nuclear point of view and my shareholder point of view, which is a big green power, sustainability is our core. So when we refer to doing this issue, it's a natural course for us. We do not take it as a burden. We do not take it as a challenge. We take it as a need that this is our core in the business that we do. Be Green Power has been around for 145 years. Dr. Harold Ling keep on reminding me that his intention to last another 100 years. And we are, our Nicola is a 3-year-old company. So the aspiration of where we want to be lead us into what we are doing today. Renewable energy. We don't have the NETR before we enter into this business. We think that it's crucial for us to invest, develop renewable energy in Malaysia, in the region, in the form of whether solar or in the form of biogas, bio-CNG, biomethane ecosystem. Then it's something that I have a 23-year-old daughter, a bit older than yours. But we are thinking about the future, right? As we think about the future, making money is an important tool, is required, but we need to do it sustainably. We need to think about it in the longer term. So in our instance today, we need to think about it in 100 years. So to us, is the challenge is all within. And we need to be ready and embrace whatever comes what may, I suppose, and take it to the next level.
So Masliza and Musha actually touched on the tax incentive. So as an issuer, do you think what we have now, are they sufficient? And also, just talking about the current regulatory frameworks, are they sufficient enough to encourage issuance?
Okay, let's talk a bit about tax. I think we all agree that we all need the tax exemption. I think we should continue that. But in terms of the operation sufficiency of where we are at today, I think Malaysia do have a very good tax and operation cost incentive. We have the ITA, Investment Tax Allowance. We are very heavily capital intensive business. So the ITA helps us a lot, for sure. The sukuk bonds, stamp duty exemptions, and so on and so forth, I think that should be maintained, at least for the coming year. And if you look at where we are going in terms of becoming a net zero by 2050, target 70% installed capacity by 2050 for renewable energy, IRENA have said that we're going to cost us about 1.8 trillion ringgit. That's a lot of investment. So more government support obviously is required to do that. On regulatory front, I think we need clear policy, sorry for that, on RE programs, how it's going to work, how to meet a target, grid modernization are something that's very, very important. And we all know from renewable energy perspective, for Malaysia to succeed, battery storage is very, very important. So we need a BESS to work. For BESS to work, we need incentive. We need the FIT program to be put in place. Dato' Sri has just left the building, but I think we also need to encourage more RE listing. We need to spur investments in the country, not only from domestic, but also from institutional, foreign as well. Our Nicola has Be Green, as I say, 145-year-old company that have invested in us. And we believe that not one company can do it all. I think it's a collective effort from everybody to make this transition works. And sustainability has to be at the core of whatever we do. Thank you.
Musha, as ASEAN, as a region, are our current regional policies and actions sufficiently aligned with the climate risk that we face?
Oh gosh, that's a tough question. I can't really speak to looking at the climate policies vis-a-vis the Paris Agreement or the climate risks that we face. I think that's more of a climate policy question. That's a bit outside of my that's a bit outside of my expertise. But what I can speak to is the approach to capital markets and to sustainable finance from ASEAN. And in that sense, I have very good news. I mean, I think that the ASEAN regulators have done, frankly, an amazing job at putting forth standards, sometimes voluntary, sometimes not, for sustainable finance products that are very much in line with global standards, and in fact, potentially more strict. So let me give the prime example, which is the ASEAN green bond standards and the ASEAN social bond standards now. Both of those are based on the global green bond principles and the social bond principles. And in fact, they're a little bit more strict in terms of requiring external reviews and in terms of excluding fossil fuels. Now, when I talk about the global green bond principles, social bond principles, these are not documents that myself and my colleagues sit in a tower somewhere and draft and expect everyone to follow. And they're not regulations either. They're not done by technocrats. Basically, what we do at ICMA, the way we work as a trade association, is we bring together all of the different stakeholders from around the world, investors, underwriters, issuers, and also NGOs, to come up with basic guidance for what is credible, legitimate, sustainable finance. So back to ASEAN, what I am impressed with is that the ASEAN authorities have taken that process, taken that concept, and ensured that the standards that are put in place for ASEAN are consistent with global standards, but also work for ASEAN as well. The second example I would give is the ASEAN taxonomy, which is a very interesting project that I'm honored to be involved in from an industry perspective. Now, this is actually quite tricky when you're looking at taxonomies. There's a lot of debate, and sometimes it can get a little bit philosophical and political about, you know, whether there should be one big taxonomy for the entire planet, or whether every country should have its own taxonomy. I try to stay a little bit away from that because I think the answer is actually somewhere in between. I think there are good reasons for having as much consistency as possible in terms of what is green and what is not green, especially from the point of view, and this is very important, from the point of view of international asset managers and investors who are some of the biggest sustainable finance investors and some of the most influential parties in sustainable finance. So for them, it's absolutely crucial that the regulations and the standards around sustainable finance products and the taxonomies are as consistent as possible, that the methodologies be as consistent as possible. Now, having said that, I do think, personally, this may not be everyone at ICMA, but personally, I do think there is a role for regional and national taxonomies for two reasons, two main reasons. One is that often there are aspects of individual countries in terms of sectors that are more common, like let's take palm oil in Malaysia, right? Palm oil may not be a globally, you know, top five industry, but it's certainly very important to Malaysia, right? And if there are aspects of metrics and sectoral guidance, technical guidance in terms of specific industries for specific countries, that can actually be very additive and useful and not inconsistent with any other taxonomies. The second very important point, and I think this is applicable for ASEAN as well, is that a national taxonomy gives informal or formal support for the national industry. So when you're talking to issuers, you can point to a national taxonomy and say, this is how you do it. And if you're able to tick these boxes and have this level of ambition in your particular sector, then you are going to be covered from a national regulatory point of view. And a global taxonomy or a taxonomy that you're using from a different country simply will not have that kind of authority or power at a corporate level.
Hi, just to add on, I think I was fortunate to be the sole representative from the Investment Banking Association to work on the SRI taxonomy. I think SC just launched that. And I mean, just to Mushtaq's point, it is good to actually have some localized taxonomy because, I mean, if you look at the context of Malaysia, we are a developing economy. And obviously, our corporates mostly are in a transition phase. And with that, there are a lot more guidance that would be required, and examples to provide the corporates and market players, intermediaries like myself, in terms of what works, in terms of economic activities that are acceptable, and to avoid a perception of greenwashing. Especially, I think, with the recent launch of SRI linked, there are a lot more ambiguity in terms of what sustainability performance targets are acceptable. So that guidance is very helpful. And what is encouraging about the SRI taxonomy that was launched was that it's principles-based. It's not prescriptive because the market is not ready yet. And it allows guidance, but it does not ebb the euphoria or the enthusiasm from the market participants. Yeah.
So I have a next question for Raja, I mean, and then after that, I'll open the floor for questions. So do fill up your question cards. Okay, so just building on what we've discussed, is it in your opinion, do you think the regulatory environment is conducive enough for Islamic sustainable finance? And also, can you perhaps mention some of the existing gaps and what really needs to be addressed?
Yep. So I'll come from the perspective of a capital markets facilitator as well as a financial institution in terms of the regulatory framework in Malaysia. So generally, the framework in Malaysia is very conducive, as I mentioned. It's one of the key factors earlier, which is spurring the growth of the market. So it's very facilitative. It's very clear in terms of the guidelines, so which helps us in terms of structuring products. How does it work? What is acceptable? And also complementing that with the ICMA guidelines as well, which gives a whole range of KPIs for sustainability-linked bonds. You know, what is what should be structured for different industries. So the regulatory framework is there from a capital markets perspective, which is facilitative. Now, from a central bank perspective as well, given that you know we also lend a lot in the financing space. There's the financial sector blueprint. You know, there's the CPPT. There's the stress testing, which is required in the future as well. All which spurs banks to facilitate green and financing transactions. But just a word of caution in the sense that while this is all facilitative from a bank perspective, it's catalytic for us to you know go out and do this because we need to report on our position. There still needs to be a bit more encouragement from the market sense in terms of the clientele. And what I mean about that is that when we did a quick snapshot of different countries, you know how does the regulatory framework feed into catalyzing green financing? We did see that, I know tax is a very sensitive topic, but just to share, in countries such as China, as well as Europe, there is a carbon tax which is imposed on corporates. Now, of course, we know that we're not ready for that in this country. It's a sensitive topic. You know, we've just done away with GST a couple of years ago. To reintroduce it again is, you know, it's a hot topic. But really what happens in these countries is that because there's a regulatory tax impetus, which means that clients in those jurisdictions come to banks and say that, look, I need to change. I need to put aside X amount of capital to pay for the carbon that I'm emitting. Can you please help me to transition? So that's slightly the different situation. In Malaysia, it's more like the banks go out to the market to say that this is the expectations. The respective guidelines under Bursa requires if you want to be on the FTSE for good, you need to make the respective disclosures. You know, things like this, we go to the market and tell them that they need to do. Of course, there's a certain spur because you won't be on FTSE for good, you won't be covered by certain stocks. But in other markets where they have that regulatory impetus, they come to the banks and then it becomes a collaborative process. Now, what is also the reality is the cross-border, the CBAM, which is imposed by EU on supply chains. So, like it or not, you know, Malaysian exporters are going to be subject to these requirements, and they are going to need to show their own transition pathway and how they are not contributing to the importer's scope 3. So, therefore, because of those sort of guidelines, it really sort of pushes the corporate sector to also ride along with the financial institutions, because it cannot only be the financial institutions which catalyzes the market.
Muslim, maybe I can have you share your opinions on that as well before I open the floor to the questions.
Amir said a lot. Okay, so I think generally in terms of the regulatory framework, I do feel that local framework is very complementary, very conducive, and helpful to market participants, issuer clients. I do feel that that there has been multiple engagements with various stakeholders to come up with the framework, whether it's issuer clients, intermediaries like myself, and other third-party players as well. Even the rating agencies were involved in multiple working task groups. There were so many. So I think at the end of the day, it's about creating a holistic end-to-end ecosystem. So you'd have the supply, which is the fundraising market, the issuer clients, and you have the end investors, be it the wholesale or basically the institutional investors, and it would be also helpful to even look at the retailers, the high net worth individuals as well. So I would say a complete ecosystem would need to be sustainable going forward for this market to continue to grow. With assistance of the government in terms of incentives, but once the market is at a steady state, then they can relook at whether the incentives can be reduced or released.
Okay. When you would like to?
I'd just like to add a few things. We talk about framework, we talk about policies, and today the framework, whether it's ASEAN SRI or Malaysian SRI framework, SESR framework, I find that, okay, we did the CBI ones, right, Climate Bond Initiative. They are data-led, science-led, to be aligned for the 1.5 degrees pathway that under the Paris Agreement. It works well if we are science-led too. And it makes life kind of easier from an issuer that we know where are we going to hit to and where the line that we are drawing. Yeah. So I find that that's maybe something that we need to think about to go into that kind of pathway rather than just qualitative in nature. The second thing I just want to point out that, you know, recently Europe has just announced that they're going to collect all the data for those importers who are bringing their goods in the form of steel, fertilizers, and so on and so forth, that they are now collecting data for introduction of carbon tax in 2 years' time. So if we Malaysians exporters are not ready, we're going to have a problem. That's for sure.
Are there any questions from the floor? I say we have to... All right. Question here in the front.
Well, if you don't mind, I stand up. Otherwise, I get nervous. Assalamualaikum. My name is Sohaimi. It's good to be able to get this opportunity to ask a question at the very first session, because these are very core sessions anyway. All right, a couple of things I hope you don't mind. First is on the word transition itself. Now, it's not a simple word as transition, okay? It means a lot. So I'm not going to elaborate, but it means a lot, the word transition. Now, second thing is about policy regulation. And here I want to link it to labor-intensive industries.
Sorry, Encik Suhaimi, but perhaps you can go straight to the question, just in the interest of time. Straight to the question.
Yeah, okay, fine. Labor-intensive, this is one way we can tackle it, right? Advancement, modernization. Okay. Now, my question is a financial matter. Okay. Now, in the scheme of things right now, regime where interest rate is going up, and I think capital markets should play a more intense role. But then capital markets are meant for big players. So how can we go really provide capital market opportunities? And because this will lead to lower financial costs for the small players, SMEs, and so on and so forth. Thank you.
Thank you. Who would like to take that question? Basically, how can we involve smaller players in the capital market?
Just Suhaimi, I'm also very nervous. Maybe I'll answer that if you don't mind. You know, I think that's a challenge. We as issuer, we raised two Sukuk issues, both 390 million each, and we did the first CBI Sukuk in the world. But having said that, when we are operating in power plants around in different states and so on and so forth, one of the ideas obviously is do a smaller issues, and for investors to pick it up. The reality is, unfortunately, the advisors, the bankers, the institutional investors will say that you're too small. That's the unfortunate thing. I do not know how they can convince issuer to do a 80 million or 50 million program, and the financiers or the investor will say that it takes me the same time to process your credit for 50 million, the same time I will process for 1 billion. That is our problem today.
I could get the bankers to address this.
Okay, very tricky question, but it's a very good question. Thank you for that. To be honest, capital market currently within the local landscape, it's more of a wholesale market. So generally, you do need economies of scale. And unfortunately, that does not apply for SMEs. In fact, I think generally we did the math, unless you're having a program and you have multiple tabs, a one-off issuance size of 150 million ringgit, not dollars, ringgit, is basically a good size to manage the issuance costs. And that generally would not fit SME requirements. That's a bit too large. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is an age-old problem, Encik Suhaimi. I mean, I have been all over Malaysia speaking to, you know, so many different type of companies who wanted to access the capital markets, and, you know, it was challenging from a scale perspective, as mentioned. However, I mean, as an advice to those companies who do, number one is that if you have a bankable project, so we have finance companies who have a concessionary agreement from a credit-worthy entity such as the government or a corporate, for example. So if you have a supplier agreement, you have a concessionary agreement, you know, you have, you're building schools and hospitals on behalf of MOHE, or you have a contract to maintain a university, you know, these projects can be bankable because of the counterparty risk. So if you are not, if you don't have the scale on an issuer basis yourself, always look to secure projects which you can then raise financing, such as you know, a project financing transaction. Now, if that doesn't work and you still want to go on a corporate basis to assess the capital markets, there used to be Dana Jamin, which was active in the market, which provided that guarantee. Some banks provide coverage as well, which will elevate your rating to that of the bank's AAA status. But also there is entities such as CGIF, which is... has done a guarantee in the Malaysian market, and they're looking to expand themselves. So CGIF guarantee, again, you need to pay for the guarantee fee, of course, but you do the mathematics. What is the rate that you can achieve with that guarantee cover versus what you would achieve on a standalone basis? And if it still works out, then, you know, then the economics is there.
So Mushtaq, you wanted to?
No, actually, Amir made my points more eloquently than I would have. So that's fine.
Okay, great. Is there any more questions if we continue? Oh, there's one here.
This guy is more shy than Suhaimi.
Yeah. So this question is to everyone. And basically, what is the end state position of sustainable taxonomy for Malaysia that is most useful for the transition to net zero? Who is brave enough to answer this?
I can take a crack at it. I might eat my words. I might get in trouble for this. But I think ultimately, let's take an even bigger picture, right? What are we trying to accomplish with all this? We're trying to transform the economy. We're trying to combat climate change, right? We're trying to create impact in terms of the environment. So let's start from first principles and move from there. So if we want to do that, if we want to create impact, we want to create issuance, we want to create projects, we want to facilitate transition. And if we want to do that, what kind of taxonomy do we need? Well, the taxonomy should ideally be one, I think it goes back to my previous answer, it should ideally be one that is consistent enough with international standards and taxonomies to be able to attract not only investment in Malaysia, but investment globally. And I think both are absolutely important. I think both markets are crucial, especially for sustainable finance. And frankly, for Islamic sustainable finance, I mean, look, we all know that there is enormous amount of investable investment assets available that would be happy to direct themselves towards Islamic finance. There's an enormous amount of assets available that would happily direct themselves towards sustainable finance. So we have actually two huge pools of global assets here that aren't even Malaysia specific that can help. And so the taxonomy can be a great tool to give sustainable finance products the credibility in a global context. But at the local level, however, and I think Ben Guan spoke to this as well, CBI standards, for example, the taxonomy can be very useful in giving technical guidance to make sure that a company knows exactly how far it has to go, exactly what it has to do, exactly what it needs along its transition pathway. And that, I think, gives confidence to a corporate. I mean, I don't have the direct experience, but in my conversations with CFOs, for example, they want to know what other companies have done. They want to know, what are my targets, right? They don't want to go into it blind. And I think that is where a taxonomy, and especially a national taxonomy, can be very, very useful. It just gives you the roadmap.
Maslisa?
Yeah, so we discussed quite a bit about this, and I think it should be in stages. That was the consensus of the committee. So generally, what we worked with was a first stage principles, then potentially going into science-based. But it's subject to constant engagement and continuous engagement with stakeholders, because you don't want to have a shock and awe and no issuances at all. You want to be able to ensure that whatever you are doing, you are as inclusive as possible so that you don't alienate a bigger part of the market. Going directly into science-based may be a little bit too much shock and awe in terms of the current market participants. But I would say eventually it will be science-based. And even in the interim, there should be a lot more data to be shared, a lot of case studies, so that the market will be able to use this data in terms of tapping the market.
We have one question here in the front. Mike is here.
Maybe I can just add a bit of words on that. Yep. You know, when we talk about our pathway, we are very clear where we want to hit by 2050. We want to be 70% installed capacity in renewable energy, for example. We want to be net zero by 2050, for example. The amount of money that we need to do to get there is about 1.8 trillion ringgit. 1.8 trillion ringgit. So look at the number. And where are we today? So if we need to kind of position ourselves and to add on to what Maslita said, maybe we should do grading. You know, grade A for people who are database, grade B for people who are, led in principles. So that investors knows, right? So when investors knows that if you're being graded, you are grade A, so it's easier for you to be graded, and maybe we can get cheaper cost of financing for that on that basis. And if you're grade B, so you're grade B. It doesn't mean you don't qualify, but you're grade B. That may work.
Can I just say a quick response to that? I think that's a great idea, and this is a point that I try to make, especially in Asia, as opposed to in some of my global conversations, because the conversation globally tends to be, you know, what is green? What is the line between green and not green, right? And it's like there's some absolute that is consistent throughout, you know, the cosmos, which is actually not true, because investors have very different perceptions of what they are willing to accept and what is not. And this is the case even in Europe, even in the US. There are some investors who are just tick the box. If it looks green, if somebody said it's green, that's good enough. I'm not saying that's wrong, but that's, you know, that's what a lot of them say. But many investors will go the extra mile, and some investors will be super, super strict. Right, so I think having a taxonomy that has gradations, but the most important thing is that the taxonomy has specific levels, specific guidance, and allows and encourages, and perhaps it requires, the issuer to be very transparent. And then, you know, depending on the issuer, depending on the projects, you know, maybe 90% of investors will say it's good enough. Maybe 30% of investors will say it's good enough. But that's okay, because that will encourage that fraction of investors to still participate in the product.
Yes. Thank you. My name is Naripa. I'm extending what Mushtaq just highlighted just now. I just came back from Jaffe in Edinburgh, Scotland. There was a lot of conversation on different shades of green, but the intense discussion was on not just on TCFD for transition to low carbon policy, but also to TNFD, which is Task Force for Nature Related Financial Disclosure. It was new to me at that time. And basically it's focusing on the financial flows away from nature negative outcomes and towards nature positive outcomes. So my question is, do we have standards here already that would be meeting the TNFD? Because the TCFD 11 questions is already under the bridge. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Naripa.
I can speak to that with some level of authority. I think the answer is we don't have the same detail and same depth of standards that we do for climate, right? So, but we have made a start, and I'll give two examples. First of all, the Green Bond Principles, you know, which ICMA published, and again, just shameless pitch, you can download them from the web for free. They're very short, they're easy to understand. They do include, in terms of what can be a green bond project or an environmental project, such things as biodiversity, reforestation, ocean health, you know, blue bonds. So all of these things that deal with nature as opposed to climate are very much and have for many years been included in what is a sustainable finance instrument. And again, everything I'm saying here can apply to Islamic products as well, right? So the sustainable finance world embraces nature as well as climate very clearly. Now, in terms of the technical standards, I think there has been quite a lot of work done. So even CBI, for example, has technical standards on biodiversity. Many other NGOs and climate consultancies have ways of looking at nature, looking at nature metrics. But it is a little bit harder. First of all, I think you know, most of the focus has been on climate for all these years. So the technical and academic work, I think, is more developed there. And secondly, nature is more complex than just climate, right? With climate, you have one KPI. You have greenhouse gas emissions, and that's about it. And that's totally easy. It's not easy, but it's clear, right? And it's comparable everywhere. With nature, you have many different kinds of aspects to the ecosystem, many different ways of measuring that. You know, how do you measure water? How do you measure trees? How do you measure diversity? These are not as simple questions, and they don't always work together. So I think the work is being done. It's in progress. And I think I'm optimistic that just like TCFD, you know, the nature-based metrics will be developed very, very, very fast now.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, can I just chime in real quick on that? So I think just to come back to the earlier question of what is the end state for the Malaysian ASEAN taxonomy and the Malaysian capital markets is moving into that sphere of things. So we talk about the phasing approach. So you start with the use of proceeds approach, then you move on to an SBTI approach, and then after that, later on, you move on to nature-based solutions, which I think is the interesting area, which has not really been explored at most yet. There's a lot of literature about it. We've seen some issuances. The World Bank has done the Rhino Bond. Some countries, Gabon and Belize, have done a nature for debt swap, all which falls into, you know, these kind of things. So I think the next end state of the Malaysian capital markets and the Islamic taxonomy is to move more into these impact-based outcome funding.
I think we have one question here.
Hi, Mustafa Aydemir, Saturna Capital. I want to apologize to the other panelists. Just a question to Raja Amir. Last year in your keynote, you were mentioning a very ambitious triple bottom strategy for HSBC Amana. Just wondering about the progress. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that question. and it was not planted, by the way. It's an honest question. So, So thank you for the question. So last year, again, I was standing on that side of the stage, and we launched the triple bottom line framework. The framework, again, just to recap, was it was given a second party opinion by the United Nations Global Compact Malaysia Brunei. So we have spent the whole of between 22 and earlier this year, and the team is actually sitting right over there, so you know they have all the intricate details of what went into it. So what happened is that we then started to quantify the assets in the retail book as well as the wholesale book, which qualifies with the triple bottom line definition as disclosed in the framework. So as mentioned earlier in the opening, we have reported on the number, the percentage of our financing which aligns with the framework, which came out at 49%. So 49% of our advances and financing, both in the retail and wholesale book, so that comes up to about 16 billion ringgit, 49% of which, almost half, is in alignment with that framework. So to in order for us to also ensure that number is free from any to ensure that it was verified, we had PwC come in and provide a limited assurance on the number and data extraction. So they've come in, they've given us a verification limited assurance report, which we have also uploaded on our website together with our TCFD disclosure for 2022, where we have disclosed that 49%. So alhamdulillah, 49% of our book is in alignment with that framework, and we hope from year to year to scale that up to, you know, to a level which is within our ambition of 51%. But I mean, I must say that standards are ever evolving, even for ourselves. So what we set out in 2020 may not be deemed as we move into a more science-based regime now. So ultimately, we will align back with HSBC Group's transition pathway, which is 1.5 degree Paris-aligned agreement, and it's also based on ultimately on science-based targets. So ultimately, that will fold back in.
Excellent. Anyone, I think we have time for one more question before we wrap up. Yes, we do have one.
good morning to the panelists. So I'd just like to ask one question on regulation. So I think some of the panelists mentioned economic sense, among other things, obviously. So there is a question about social finance. When it comes to regulation, it's hybridity. So obviously, it's a combination between social businesses and, of course, the idea of commercializing social businesses. So in terms of adapting regulation to social businesses. So that means dealing with the hybridity aspects, so like value hybridity in terms of the expectations of the investors versus the expectations of the recipients. So you've got like the line blurring between beneficiaries and customers as well. So would you say that the regulatory framework, I think some of the panelists mentioned facilitative regulatory frameworks as well, would you say that these frameworks are unique enough to deal with the social finance hybridity? So that's my question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Masliza?
Okay, I hope I can answer that question. So, yes, the framework covers a green, social, sustainable, which is a hybrid, And now a sustainability of SRI-linked framework as well. So yes, there have been issuance locally on the social tenants. In fact, a lot of the Dafia banks have issued social bonds or social sukuk. There are also many sustainable SRI issuances, which is a hybrid of both. It's green, of course, is a lot more common because there's a lot more utilization for green-based projects. But from the financial institution side, we do see a lot more social issuances, and they have been very well received. For framework, to us, it's still very facilitative and complementary because it is it equates to all efforts on the green and SRI linked. I hope that answers the question. Yeah,
just to add, so specifically to side out certain frameworks. I mean, so Masliza did mention the SC framework on SRI, which also includes social. And you know, we have issued a sukuk by MyEG, which complies with that aspect of the social framework, specifically for affordable housing for foreign workers. But if you just extract some global frameworks, so the World Bank has an impact evaluation handbook. I see IFCs in the room as well. They have also a framework on IFCs anticipated impact measurement and monitoring framework, and it's broken down by sectors. We have the GIIN IRIS Plus catalogue of matrix, UNEPFI's impact analysis tools. And also we understand that the World Bank and Bank Negara will be releasing a report in November with regard to social impact and adherence to global framework used by capital providers. So there is a whole plethora of existing frameworks.
Excellent. And on that note, we're out of time. Thank you so much for the questions. They were really, really good. And, thank you so much to all my panelists. That was an excellent session, very insightful, and appreciate you sharing your thoughts today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more discussions on the Islamic finance industry, log on to www.islamicfinancenews.com. You can also listen to IFN Podcast on your favorite platforms, including iTunes and Spotify.